Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Such a sweet introduction. And I'm just thinking, I must have been complaining about something, I'm pretty sure. So, Dr. Rovessa, I never thought I'd let you know. And Professor Rovessa offered to my students at the University of California, Davis, and Chivas, and Lorena. And what I thought I would do today is share a little bit of how I came to this project and what I've learned. But the first thing I want to say is how excited I am to be talking to people who are actually from New Mexico. So your job is to help me out. Help me out with your own memories of the Alianza, and then help me out with what you think of my historical interpretations. You can go thumbs up or thumbs down, but I really am interested. Okay. And Esteban already gave you a little bit of background about the fellowship. Let me tell you what I'm up to. I am busy sort of taking it piece by art, piece right now. I'm busy in a book-length project on the history of the Alianza. And because this is a group filled with New Mexicans, many of you already know this because my coffee booth is in the way. This was a land battle condition in the 1960s, the Catapult Special Attention, right? And it had thousands and thousands of members who were seeking land that had once been granted to their ancestors by the Spanish and Mexican governments, and then lost through legal, and that's really clear, extra legal means after 1848. Everyone got that? That's the Alianza. Okay. That's our starting point. And what I was really struck with when I first came to the Center for Southwest Research, and this was for an earlier book, was that no one had written that much about the Alianza in the intervening years, like the height of this, biggest phase, 67. And then there's kind of like a 40-year lull, nearly a 40-year lull. And I'm really surprised by this, because this is a really dramatic story. This is incredibly juicy. This is theoretically sophisticated. We may not catch it in the next 30 minutes, but we're going to get it. And also, it's incredibly pertinent even today, right? The land grab struggle continues. In fact, you can credit the events, I think, with being invigorated in a way that it cannot be ignored or forgotten. Right? There's still a lot of work to be done, but there's some basic foundational work that's done in the 1960s. Okay. What we want to do right now is try to figure out why this history hasn't been tackled. And I think part of the reason has to do with my title, that there are still, I mean, for a lot of people, the Alianza isn't something in the history book. Although, let me tell you, to a lot of people, they're going to hear anything about it, it's going to be a line or two in the history book. But to people in New Mexico, it's something, it's lived experience still. And it's within their personal memory, and sometimes those memories aren't entirely positive. This is a very complicated story with a very controversial leader. So I'm just going to have you help me out, and I'm going to say, the Alianza, and you're going to tell me what are some of your memories. Please. Not? I don't believe that. How many of you have ever heard of Reyes López Medina? Thank you. Do you know I asked that in my classroom in California? 120 students? No one raised their hand. Tell me how much those records you get. Okay. How many of you have heard of June 5th, 1967, in the courthouse raid? Cool. What are your memories? I'm giving you a little trigger finger. Help me out.
I didn't live in New Mexico at that time.
Oh, so you heard it from far away?
In Chicago.
And what did you hear?
Well, it was in the progressive movement literature, probably not in the mainstream media. And I don't remember how or where, but I know that we heard that it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and about the land hand struggle and about the gunshots and everything.
Gunshots, yeah. The gunshots make me.
But see, America was seen as a hero.
The Indian hero, cool. That's exactly right. Especially in the media of the time. Any other memories? Any of you activists from that time period? Were any of you members of the Alianza or no members of the Alianza? There's a range of opinions, I guess.
And I think one reason that, I mean, maybe you'll speak to this, that it's dropped from consciousness is because the mainstream media refuses to cover it.
Well, we can add that. I have my own reasons, but we can add yours.
Okay.
Well, I think that sense is that people's memories of the Alianza, if they know anything at all, they know about one day and one man, right? And my goal as a historian has always been to get beyond that framework. And then the one day is this day, June 5th, 1967, where you do have a shootout at a courthouse. This picture, by the way, was taken by me when I was in Tantilon, Nuevo Mexico, last summer. It was right after Balthazar Martin was one of the courthouse leaders to die. And I was driving around Tantilon with Maria Leyva, who was married to another courthouse leader. And we saw this, and I really like this photo because it dramatically captures the poverty of living in Mexico, right? There's a reason you have a land grant movement. There's a reason you have a demand for some sort of economic sustenance here. But also, I turned around to my neighbor, and I said, is this where Balthazar Martinez lived? And she goes, oh, no. He just liked to write that everywhere. It shows you how important this one day is, right? And he's a dynamite kid because the story goes, he had either shafts of dynamite or wooden blocks that he painted to look like dynamite, or who knows. But he carried that nom de guerre, that was his warrior name, Dynamite Kid. Okay. So, we have some memories, not as many as I was hoping. I have to tell you that we have the memories of the Alianza reduced to getting in the courthouse, right? We also have, because, as you mentioned, the progressive movement, getting that emerging as the hero of the Chicano movement, okay? And the Chicano movement was really the topic of my first book, and so this overlaps in certain ways and does it. But it's really clear in the literature of the Chicano movement, but still, there's something called the four horsemen of the Chicano movement, right? Who might they be?
The first
Jose Antonio Gutierrez of the Barras Unida Party in Texas. Who else?
Jorge
Gonzalez of the Prisoners for Safe Justice, Colorado, and then Rey López Irina.
This is a very violent movement,
right? But they're praised. They are recognized as heroes because these are people who are leading the way and saying we're going to resist assimilation, we're going to strive for cultural nationalism, we're going to take on the system. And then the idea of the leader of the leaders, because it's not just about militant words, it's about militant deeds. Okay. So we have a little picture of Tirina and the courthouse. We have a little picture of Tirina and the Chicano movement. And let me tell you why I'm not satisfied with those little pictures, or maybe taking a step back, how I got involved in this myself. I said I was here 10 years ago, and I was looking at the Chicano movement, specifically its protest in the Vietnam War. Because my training is in the Chicano history, so in the history of American formulations. And Tirina is a fascinating figure because you know he was an anti-war leader within this broader progressive movement. He emerges not just as a leader to the Chicanos, but a leader to a lot of lefties in the 1960s. And the way he talked about the Vietnam War was really interesting. He kept drawing comparisons between New Mexico and Vietnam, right? So in New Mexico in 1848, you had a 40 mayor, and then ever since then, the four conflict people have been living in the legacy of Congress, especially that loss. And he said, well, you know, in Vietnam, you have a foreign invader. You have French colonialism. You have a threatened culture. And then you have this American military occupation where too many similarities, and therefore that war isn't ours. I thought, man, this guy's really interesting. And I wanted to know more about it. In fact, as I was doing this research, Vietnam War is my focus, I kept drifting to other things, right? Because there's just a lot of interesting stories here. Here's the redone courthouse. It used to be pink and oak. Then we have, and the bullet holes don't show anymore. But that courthouse raid is really interesting. And look, this is a picture of Jamie Mack on the 40th anniversary. I'm sorry, I'm not a great photographer, the reason it's little is because it was big, like pixels. I wouldn't be getting it. But on the fort, look, if he too goes back to that day, this was taken June 5th, 2007. And you can see this is a really dramatic person. A lot to say, even today. He was in between making these huge gesticulations and like having many heart attacks and keeping on. He kind of fade off and then come back. So it still tells you how important it was. And he's another person. I mean, as part of the story, he too intrigued me. There's the drama of the Alianza members, Los Aliancistas, coming together at the Echo Amphitheater in October 1966, when, some of you might know, members of this group tried to arrest, fortunately they did, they arrested two Forest Service Rangers on grounds of trespassing and being a public nuisance. And this was where the trial was held. This picnic bench becomes the courtroom. Okay? This is like good stuff. And yet when I look at the secondary literature, it just seems reduced to the Alianza as biography. Right? The Alianza is the history of one man. And then that history itself was further reduced. I noticed there was a certain slickness, I guess, where everything was kind of, even getting his biography, he attempted to tell the same stories over and over again. So we know he was born in a cotton field, we know he grew up as a poor migrant farm worker, we know he was a charismatic, well, he didn't say charismatic, everyone was, but he was a fundamentalist preacher, traveling preacher. Like, there's a sameness there. But how do you break past that? Right? How do you get past one man in one day? I mean, because an estimate is that there are 6,000 members of the Alianza, or at least 5,999, we don't know much about, right? And it lasted for a long time. So what about all those other days?
Okay, these are the sort of questions that I've been trying to deal with. And the way I've come up with answers is two strategies. I should look at the clock to make sure that I don't keep you too late.
Don't worry about it.
Nah, says the person who doesn't have to catch a train. So, I think what I'm going to do is give you the first strategy, is the idea of the memory entrepreneur, in a really sketched out form. And then I'm going to give you a footnote. And if you want to read more, you can go read the article, okay? And then I'll spend more time on the second strategy, because this is where I was lying with Sola. I'm making it up as I go along, as far as interpretive framework. Okay. So, when I have these other questions, what about those other people, what about those other beings? And also, I mean, you can't really write a history of the Alianza without including Kadena, right? He's kind of a big part of the history. So how do you include him, but like include him in relationship with other people? These are my new questions, by the way. We're making progress, if you remember that line. Okay. When I have these new questions, I can say, whew, amen. It turns out to Drew, who's state the attorney general's office, and the governor's office are really interested in the Alianza. So there are boxes and boxes of information on the Alianza in the state archives in San Jose. And then he did it himself. His collection was opened April 2005 here. 80 boxes and all. So I have all of these documents. I have a lot of archival research. Still making my way through, because man, I don't know how to write.
And if not, you wouldn't get any sources.
It would be a very different picture, absolutely right. So, these are my sources. And when I show you pictures, they're mostly going to be from the archive, okay? Not these, I stole these from the web, sorry. But the most will be from the archives. So let me go through my two strategies as quick as I can. The first one is to think of Diana as a memory entrepreneur. That's the Echo Amphitheater where they arrested those Forest Service Rangers. Now, this concept of a memory entrepreneur, I am stealing with proper footnoting from a woman, an excellent scholar who works on history of memory. This is a hot topic in a lot of different fields in Argentina. Her name is Elizabeth Jabin, J-E-L-I-N. And honestly, she wrote a book that the subtitle could be History of Memory for Dummies. I really like that book. Because, not that I'm a dummy, but there is so much literature, and she synthesizes it in this really helpful way. And she talks about a memory entrepreneur because she's really interested in human rights activists in Argentina and elsewhere, Chile and Brazil, who were trying to bring up the story of disappeared people in the 1980s and the brutality of state violence and how they had to kind of fight with the government to put forth the story. And so in Jardine's definition, a memory entrepreneur is someone who will use a male singular picture, who puts the full force of his personality in putting forth an alternative narrative of the past. A narrative that has been formally suppressed or submerged. And so I read that passage, full force of his personality, and thought, oh my goodness, this is Giardino. So we're going to see what was Giardino's, well, you can see it here. What was his, what was, I'll just ask you guys, what was his narrative? How was it challenging the official story in Mexico? If I say true to Guadalupe Hidalgo, what do you guys say?
Does
everyone do it? Sorry.
We made a lot of promises in America. Interpretation. Any Mexican living from Mexico could keep his or her land if they became Mexican.
Actually, no, there were a lot of promises in all the senior territory beyond New Mexico.
Right.
But there were promises of bad justice. Yeah. Okay, let's just be easy. We're going to go. How many of you have heard of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo? Yay! The peace treaty that ended the U.S.-Mexico War. Okay. In 1963, if I had asked that question, maybe you wanted to remember it, raise your hands. It was something that was considered sort of an archaic document. It wasn't something that was central theme in Chicano Chicano history, for sure. Right? And you really do have to credit Lidina and the Adansa for putting forth this narrative that foregrounds conquest, that says, you know what, our lands were stolen. And he does it again and again in this really dramatic fashion. They uprooted our language, they threatened us with hunger, their judges twisted the law. And then I really like this one here. I'm stealing this from speeches that he delivers and radio programs that he produced, he delivers. And newspaper columns that he writes. This man is really, really, really busy, even before the official founding of the Alliance in 63. He's literally running all across the state, meeting people, and trying over and over to get this message out of conquest, and that lands were stolen through deceit and fraud. As he does this, he really has an important role for himself, no? You can see this. And you can see his former fundamentalist Christian background, right? There is this striking imagery of Christ on the cross. So on the one hand, you have the hand of destiny on his on the shoulders, and then you also have it. Listen, this is a little bit. It's nailed in his heart, but you think of the nails on the cross. No, it's this is getting like, speaking. Okay. So when Diana puts forth this narrative of lost land, this narrative that conquest is a process, that treaty, those promises weren't lived up to, what do you think perception is? Depends on where you look. Really, it truly depends on where you look. Let me show you a picture. Oh, here, I'm sorry, I forgot to do this. This is a young Diana. Look at how intense he is, but also how young he is, you know, there. That's him in the early 1950s. His radio program was called La Voz de la Justicia. And he was talking 10, 15 minutes a day, every day for years, in Spanish, so kind of under the radar. But a lot of people who were Spanish speakers were listening. Okay. When Diadina puts forth this narrative, the woman who used to hold the Stefan's job said, in short, this man is crazy. He said it, she said it over and over again, that Reyes was, and forgive the familiar Mr. Divina, was putting forth historical nonsense, that he was promoting historical garbage, and my favorite because it had a different connotation today, that he was historically incorrect. And she spoke with a lot of authority.
Because
she spoke in Congress
right.
to defend, in fact, one of the reasons she was opposed to the Alianza, and this is a complication I'll develop elsewhere, not in the next 15 minutes, is that she was really interested in defending native land rights.
Right.
So there was this tension.
Can you read her name? I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. This is Myra Ellen Jenkins. She's originally from Colorado. And she was a state archivist for years and years and years before New Mexico had an official state historian. She becomes the official state historian in 1968. But in years and years and years, what she does, like, literally for decades, is gather all these land grant documents into one central place, like the Mouse State Archives. So she really knew what she was talking about, and she had looked at those documents. Right, so she speaks about this authority. Not only that, she has this really wonderful role where it's like,
oh, look, my documents.
And she plays a gatekeeper. So when she says Kadena is a fraud, that his the advance of the con game, that there's no validity to his claims, people listen. And it just tells you how much of a struggle it was to put forth this counter-narrative, right? There was a backlash. Okay, in some quarters. What about in other places? What about the Spanish speakers who were listening on the radio? The hope of recovering land meant a lot to people. And it's one of the Alianza group by Lincoln Mountain. And it starts with 12 families in 63. And then we see 50 families in the next meeting, and 70. And by the mid-1960s, we're thinking 3,000, possibly twice that many families. And it's actually one of the reasons I like this idea of a memory entrepreneur. Because, as Galen will point out, it's not enough that you have someone saying, look what happened, you've got to pay attention to this. Other people have to pay attention to this kind of narrative, right? And so Galena is tapping into memories of landmass. There is a collective memory of landmass, especially in northern New Mexico, especially among impoverished people who were so dependent on land and felt it slip away generation past generation. And I don't have time to get into the complications of how it happened, but it takes a long time, and it's one reason people are still upset in the mid-1960s about a process that began in 1848. Okay? So, so many people were interested in getting this message. The state starts to worry. This is again part of the backlash. I apologize for going back and forth. But can you see this?
No.
Let me read it to you, because this is the state confidential memo. And it's in the Attorney General files, and this is just tells me the frustrations of archival research, in that the last page was possibly a signature, is gone. But it is my opinion that this organization, meaning the Alianza, poses a threat to the community action program, this is the War on Poverty program in New Mexico, that it is political dynamite, and that it is a potential danger to the maintenance of order. Now, what's really interesting is about this document that comes out in 1965, that is 2 years before the courthouse raid. And at that time, you have sporadic fence cuttings and haystack burnings, but you really don't have a massive threat of violence. You don't have people picking up guns and shooting. So the fear here is not based on the threat of violence. All the Alianza is demanding at this point is an investigation into those land claims. The fear here is based upon upon that counter narrative. Okay? Okay. So, that's one strategy, super fast. Let me move to the other one. Do you have any questions about that first strategy? Reyes López Irina is a memory entrepreneur.
How's that different from the master narrative we already have about Reyes López Irina and the audience? As you were telling it, I heard the same narrative.
You hear the same narrative, except in this regard, and it's because I went too fast, because I'm trying to go fast. In this regard, what really intrigues me about a memory entrepreneur that is that you have Reyes López Irina, and yes, he's really important, and yes, you can't ignore him, and yes, he found the organization, and he talks a lot, and people are listening, but because of the structure, when you think of him as a memory entrepreneur, essentially, you can't, and David doesn't like this term, but I'm dealing with it anyway, you can't sell a version of the past if no one's willing to buy. And so the reason I like this concept, and I haven't given them enough justice here, I don't think I mentioned them at all, is that there were a lot of takers. He is tapping into that collective memory of land loss. And so I need to, because I talk about him as a memory entrepreneur, I get to include people like Juan Martinez of Tierra Maria, who after the courthouse raid is interviewed and says, shh, we don't want war and poverty funds. We don't want powdered milk. We want the land. You know, or people like Juan Valdez, who I have a picture of, but it's
to Barry. You know, when I went to go interview him last summer, the first thing he does is go under the bed, he pulls out this little silver box, and it's filled with letters that his grandfather and his father received from the U.S. Forest Service cutting back grazing permits. Like, we're sorry, Mr. In this case, I'm not a fund as your dad. It's the middle of the Great Depression. We're sorry, we know you really need to feed your family, but we have to protect the land, and you can't raise your cattle anymore. And so, what I liked about this concept, and I'm kind of stealing from my conclusion, is that you get to include more, it's not just Nina, but it's his other voices. And one of the reasons I like talking about specifically in terms of memory is that if you look at New Mexico, there's a reason why it's the only place within the within the continental United States that you have an anti-colonial tradition springing up, a movement springing up. And because theorists of memory and history really talking about memories, forget about theorists, but just thinking about memory, it really is strongest when it's deeply rooted in one place over a long, long time. And in that case, you're talking about what is northern New Mexico.
Is memory the currency here, then? If we're talking about entrepreneurs and sellers and buyers, is memory the currency? And is there a way to exchange? And I mean, I'm just saying that. This is a very interesting...
Well, you know what? I'm going to say I don't know. Because I'm fiddling with this concept, but I'll think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, no, I like that. I mean, it might be why you gave it...
Right.
Memory is a person. You know what? I'll tell you this.
That's for surface value.
Yes.
Who's appropriate in surface value? I think you're implying that race appropriates that surface value.
Well, the thing is, I think it's really important to establish. I mean, you say this is the familiar narrative. It is now. It wasn't then. So I think you really have to give him credit. I wasn't going to say this, but I'm really glad to start speaking. If I wanted to write the National Enquirer version of race, democracy, anyhow, done. If I wanted to write what a nasty, nasty man he was, easy. That's not what I want to do. I have no interest in that at all. I mean, it doesn't... But I have to think about some of the stuff. So it's not just... When I'm talking about him, I am very convinced that he played an incredibly important role. And if it seems like something that's... Well, we already know that. We already know it because he worked so hard on it. We already know it because he gained that much support. We already know it because there's like Chicano historians like me saying, you should know this, right? I mean, so I don't want to just throw, he's not just someone taking. He's not just a taker. But I will say this, if you want to talk about exchange, that memory is one of the few resources that was truly profound in northern New Mexico. I mean, that's something that they had. Okay? Does that help a little bit? And we'll think about it. Okay. Yes. I'm still going to be excited to do it. Just looking up. Okay.
What was the word that the Argentinian scholar used that they're translating memory?
She used, oh, well, you know what? She didn't say, I thought I read it in Spanish. The book I thought was in English. So memory entrepreneur. So it's in Spanish. But okay. I don't know. I'm going to stamp it. I don't know. Okay. Second strategy. And maybe this is different or maybe this is familiar. You'll let me know. And you know what? You can also tell me what you think of the word because I just came up with it last week. So I have them on, I have Reyes kind of coming up with this commentary. But it seems to me he's also enforcing a memory of himself, his legacy within the Chicano movement. And that's what I want to talk about now. Reyes as a memory enforcer. Good. I don't know. The militaristic or policeman, I don't know. Because there's when we're talking about the landscape between history and memory, there's two levels here, right? There's this really profound memory of land loss among so many aliancistas that Reyes taps into. But there's also the memory of that movement itself, what we talked about before, how it's sort of been reduced. And so let me talk a little bit about an enforcer. And what I want to say in this regard is Reyes, to the extent that he's remembered as a Chicano movement hero, this
has a lot to do with the positioning of himself in that regard. Okay? And we just need to think about this a little bit to have the pieces fall in place. Okay. If you look in the archives, if you're looking for information on your ancestors, your number one source are the words spoken or written of Reyes López Merino. This is a perfect example. This is one of the earliest articles about the Alianza, and it comes across in 1966. He's getting all the attention. He is the Alianza. And it starts with a little bit about the organization, but then it goes straight into his biography. The internet has been used to be caught in Texas during the Depression, and on and on. And so when journalists came who were interested in what's going on, they would go to him. So he was like the source of information. He was always very willing to speak to journalists and scholars. So he was a good person to talk to. He wasn't closed. He wrote his autobiography that was published in Mexico.
Big.
One of the reasons it was published in Mexico was that it's a little bit different. You know, it has... And my guess is that Diadino is telling
editors,
no, it has to be my way. He is very much in control of this heroic narrative. Eventually, an abridged version is published in English, but it also makes sense that in the 1970s, Diadino spent a lot of time trying to get himself in movies, trying to get a movie made. In fact, he sues John Nichols, the author of the novel Winfield War, and the case is dismissed, but essentially, the allegation is that it's copyright infringement of getting his own life, right? That's how he sees it. So, he is in control here. And the question to me is, why is that control ceded to so readily? And I think this is, you're going to help me here, because you might have a better answer than I do. You actually have it. We're going to add it in, okay? I have three, but then we're going to have four. Why he is establishing the heroic narrative. I hope that made that clear. But other people, scholars and journalists around him are conceding to that heroic narrative. Are saying, yeah, that makes sense. They're just accepting it. Right? Okay. Yeah, because of course it's yes, because if they hadn't, we would know other stuff. Okay. Now, and this is again, me and the archives saying, wow, this is really juicy. This is really cool. Why am I making the same thing over and over and over again? Why haven't we moved beyond that? And thinking about this yesterday, came up with three reasons. Let me try to get them in some sort of order so they make sense according to PowerPoint. First one, and we can go back. I don't think this is going to help us. We can go back to that picture when you're like, oh, you're going like this. Do you remember that one? There was a picnic bench. Yeah. This man is an incredibly powerful speaker, right? He wins acquittal in the first courthouse rape trial because he defends himself and he wins. And he's speaking in English, and everyone says he's even more powerful speaking in Spanish. So he's not, and he's powerful not just that he can put together arguments that, well, hold on, you're in for the ride. He's powerful that you are going to hear these arguments and he's going to put them forth no matter what. If you look at some of the trial transcripts, for example, from the Echo Amphitheater trial, you can just, like, in these very lots and lots of white pages, you can just feel the rising frustration of the judge and attorneys both for the defense and the prosecution, where they say,
where were you on October 26, 1966?
And then he'll say one sentence, almost a semi-answer. You're back in 1848 and the treaty wants to get out of it. And there's no entry. You cannot get in. This is his story. Okay, so that's one reason. Second reason, in that story, he is talking about stuff that you can just imagine in journals in 1960 or in 2007. What? Right? So we know the treaty was with Bilal, but we're probably not that familiar with the Papa Bulls he likes to mention. He always says, the crack in the Liberty Bell, what the heck is that? You know, there's references to medieval canonical laws and different ways of organizations organizing land, and then never mind the constant biblical allusions where you're just thinking, man, I did go to Texas, right?
paying attention. Okay. So, I want to read you this little passage that I found yesterday. Okay, and this is from, this tells you sort of how the identity classification spreads far, but also how it's harder to get past that slipperiness. It's hard to get past that slipperiness. Okay, this is a Japanese student. In August 1976, one Chicano friend gave me an opportunity to meet Divina. Okay, he was writing an autobiography, so we know that that's establishing the narrative once again. I had an interview with him for 2 hours. Two of my questions on his political involvement, he answered using rhetorical expressions often cited from the Bible. But all I got from him was not beyond the information reported in books and articles published on him. Because you can't seem to break through this wealth of information. And just to tell you a little story, in 2007, when I'm in Coyote, when he was talking on that 40th anniversary, there was someone from, what's the newspaper in Espanola? The Sun?
The
Rio Grande Sun, yeah. So, and he was talking, he says, for one thing, let me tell you, those guys need issues, that the world's gone to hell because women are too exposed, you know, painting themselves from the top of their heads to the bottom of their feet, you know, like losing their hair to their toenails. And then, he went right off to something about the Jews, and that Roosevelt was a Jew. And so this young reporter is saying, did he just say Roosevelt was a Jew? And he goes, yeah, he just said Roosevelt was a Jew. And what the heck is a reporter supposed to do with that? You know? It's like, there's a reason. Okay, that's a second. It's really hard. In fact, in the 1960s, a lot of times, the journalists will just say, well, he said such and such and such and such. And then, like, that's like the, I used to be a journalist, so I could say, this is the escape. That's what he said. I'm not commenting. And I'm sure I'm not an investigator. In fact, there's only one book I know of that has really tried to inquire into the religious vision of Reyes López Tijerina. It's by Rudy Busco, and that's what it's called, King Tiger, Religious Vision of Reyes López Tijerina. But the reason I mention it is because it goes to point number three, why it's hard to get past this heroic narrative. You know that Busco wrote a whole really cool book about sort of these biblical illusions and making sense of them. But in mentioning that Tijerina was a fundamentalist Christian pastor, he was wrote a book in which he never managed to mention women once. There's no gender analysis. Which is the third reason that we have this heroic narrative that's just sat there, is that we're talking about patriarchy. This is the 1960s. It is understood that this man is a leader of the organization. You talk to him, who is important. He's not. He is also the head of his household. So no one talks to the women around, the women who are hard to get. That's the three reasons you have a concession to this master narrative. So, brings me to my last point before drawing conclusions. If you, let me remember. I had so much fun with all the scares, I have to tell you. We have to remember that remembering is forgetting. And that's why it took to go back to that idea of the memory entrepreneur. Really what I like about it is that it's going to allow me to talk about all these other people. Going to this idea of a memory enforcer, if we see it as something that is constructed, then we can be much more aware of what's been left out. Okay? And a lot has been left out. I'll cite one example that from an archive that I found yesterday. There's no date, but my guess is 68, 69, a woman named Della Rosa from Los Angeles. And if I'm remembering correctly, I have to double check. I think she was CPA, I think she was a Communist Party member from Los Angeles. She was a big Canadian supporter. And wrote this really cool manuscript. It is the only document I have found. The Tricycle of Nazarene. She talks to all these different people, and she talks to Rose Tijerina, who you have here, the eldest daughter, and Maria Escobar Tijerina, his first wife, who he divorced, by the way, 1 month after they lost his family. And if you look in this manuscript, this unpublished manuscript, she has one quote from a man named David Durant, and she's asking, well, who are the full-time workers for the Alianza? And Fabian says, well, he names the people, and he goes, and then there's Rose, who goes, but she's just a girl. This is exact quotation.
Which is why we kind of haven't heard about her that much. So, what I read in the manuscript, that particular manuscript yesterday, absolutely confirms what I got through oral histories with these two people. And by the way, this is taken last year in front of the Onate Center. So it's like Chicano history, it's like this centuries of Chicano history compressed into one picture. Because you have the Tierines and then there's a picture on the top. Juan de Onate, right, Adelantado de Nuevo Mexico. So, which also talks about multiple conquests, which I don't have time to talk about. Acknowledge it, right? Okay. So, in the Gold of Spanish, you find out that Tierines came to his club, blah, blah, blah. Running around the state, rose there, always taking minutes. When the Alianza is founded, or when Divina goes to Mexico to conduct research, Maria Escobar is the one supporting his children and sending money to her husband to conduct that sort of research. I could go on and on, but I'm trying to be quick. Let me just put it to you really bluntly. It's not merely contributions to history. It's not really about adding women to the picture. I'm telling you flat out, if it hadn't been for the work of these women, the Alianza would not exist at all. Okay. Phew. So, what conclusions can we draw? I love you, Tom. Okay. Goes like this. And then you tell me, say it's good, though, then it's good. Okay. But what these women have mentioned to me is really a tale of suffering. It's a tale of woe. It's a tale you're not going to find in the Diana collection. In fact, if you look at the folders of the family of his children, of his wife, because he was divorced twice, there's hardly anything there. If you look at, like, I'm in prison and writing about myself, I'm trying to be a black, I'm a family. It's big, fat collection. Okay, so here are the conclusions. First conclusion goes back to this memory entrepreneur and memory enforcer, or if you can come up with a really cool mirror pun, that would be helpful. Okay, goes like this. On the one hand, you have Didina challenging an official narrative. On the other hand, you have Didina establishing an official narrative. There's a deep, deep irony here. And I really want to explore both in the book to come. Natalie, your eyebrows are going to say, that okay or say, yeah, I got here. Okay. So this is, I think, a way to look at Diana beyond just Diana. Not ignore who he is, but look at him in relationship to other people. And when I thought of this whole thing, I thought, that's a book, man. Now I know how to break the bubbles. Thousands and thousands of documents. The second conclusion I want to draw is that something I was starting to talk to Jesse is that I think by using this framework, we get to think about the Alianza beyond one man. If we're really talking about collective memory, if we're talking about why this message is so important to so many people, if we're talking about memories that have been silenced, and let me tell you, Rose Beam is trapped. She's written a book, but if we're talking about learning and silence, then we again have a way to look at a broader picture of the Alianza beyond women's biography. And then finally, this is really cool. We're historians. Sorry, it's not an insult. I know it's your favorite word, but he's more. So we evidently think along the same lines, because my last conclusion is, you know what? I'm so grateful for this fellowship. It's really helped me spend time here. The fellowship and the Malcolm Adams, come on, have helped me spend time here in New Mexico to think about these concepts. But my last conclusion is really that there's only so much of the story in the archives. That so much of this project is going to depend upon oral histories. You better believe I'll be connecting quite a lot.
Sign me up for dance class, please.
different here in this audience than it is to be in California. So what struck me is that you're talking both about a national and a local narrative. Mm-hmm. What is known in India, I mean, it's going to be very different in New Mexico.
That's true.
I would love for you to pull that out a little bit more, because it seems like you're making the assumption of the national narrative. That's your interesting part. But it always differs locally, right? So certainly in New Mexico, that's going to differ. But I'm actually more interested in your talking about positionality in memory and in history, particularly with the Indian. Let me try to explain. I'm struck by your talking about Myra Lynn Jenkins and immediately pointing out that she's from Colorado. Right? You know, that's also about positionality, and you're taking a position like that, right? Mm-hmm. Versus Elena.
She's from Texas.
From Texas, right? And so who owns those histories? Who owns those memories? There's lots to say there about his positionality and how people remember his positionality in La Alianza as not from him. Right?
And
in really taking up this particular struggle and capitalizing, which you've already spoken about that memory of that loss. So there's that one issue of his particular positionality, how he became the entrepreneur in forging a particular narrative, a memory of where he stood for them, and how it could have differed, and this is more of a question that I don't know about, from community to community from New Mexico. And also, sorry, it's been so long, but But also, it probably differed from land grant to land grant, community to community. So if you end up focusing on where the Alianza was the strongest, right, in that particular area of TA and certain other areas, it would have differed from some of the land grants supposed to be here now. I don't know.
There seems to be, I'm going to take the last piece and then hopefully answer some of the rest. Because first, I want to say this is such a complicated story. It's like, whoa. Second, I want to say I am really grateful that I'm at least trying to write a history of the Alianza, which is a social movement or social organization in the 1960s, and not trying to, David, God bless you, like, come up with individual histories of injustices of individual land rights. Because you're right, it's such a complicated history that it puts people in a different place to even respond to the Alianza. But it seems to me there was at least three major sources of support for Thedinas. And before I tell you this story, I want to say, I think it speaks to his power, his charismatic personality. I mean, that as an outsider, he gets support from people who have lived in these villages and know. I mean, everyone's your primo, and it's not just a saying. Like, really, they are your cousin, right? So, and he gets in. It takes him a while, but he does get in, so that speaks to him. Three main supports of the Alianza, it seems to me, and again, I'm happy to stand for it, but one is in Albuquerque. So there's a lot of people who are, they see themselves as land rat heirs, which is a word they like to use, but they've already lost the land. So they're urbanized, some like urbanized native people, they're urbanized Chicanos, right? They're New Mexicans who are living in Albuquerque, and they just have so much more of a struggle to get back to that land. The second support for Thedinas, the Alianza, but if you look at membership roles, is really going to be in that northern New Mexican, those villages where you have intense poverty, and a lot of times it's a recent post-World War II phenomenon because of environmental factors and because of grazing restrictions and because of some other things. Okay. And in that northern New Mexico, I'm going to bring you up to southern Colorado because that line is, a post-1848 thing. It's not a sort of organic to the region. Okay. And then the third source of support for Tijuana is really outsiders. You have all these lefties coming in from New York, from Chicago, from L.A.
and writing for starting a Grito del Norte, for example, from Colorado. One of my favorite pieces is Too Sick to Be Here, but you know. And they just see him as like they want to be part of it. And so you have these various sources of support, and it's not like these groups all get along and all walk in step. No. In fact, if you're talking about memories of the Alianza, I've talked to people who say, you know what went wrong? It wasn't the union, it's like a prison, and there's so much power is focused on this one person, so it's hard to hold together an organization when you don't have a structure that survives without, you know, in heaven. They say, what's wrong with the Alianza is the feminists destroyed the Alianza. And they name names. It's those two women, it's not the word they use, who destroyed the Alianza. So, yeah, you have, there's multiple positions, and then I think siding with the lefties is really how he was taken as a Chicano movement hero, although the ideas of Fiorina they're different. I mean, the plan that's done is very different than focusing on the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, right? So it's a complicated relationship, but nonetheless, he's sort of blindness. Does that help a little bit? Okay.
The most amazing point to what you're saying is that the Republican candidate for governor of Mexico in 1966 used his connection with the alliances, because he's very good alliance for them.
But, yeah.
To be elected. I mean, he campaigned actively in Hispanic areas.
Uh-huh.
He supported the work of the alliance. And this is David Cardo, who won.
You know, though, although it has to, this is, there's been. There's so many more people who are expert than me, but it seems to be that starting in the 19th century, you have Spanish-speaking people sort of jerry-rigged, or gerrymandered, I guess is the right word, as sort of a block that has some power but not enough to take over. So, and when you're like, it's almost like the Chicanos in East LA, it's like you can vote for the Democrats or you can vote for the Republicans, but it ain't gonna get any better. You know, and so he did. He attended the convention. He spoke about the poverty there. He really wanted to get foreign poverty and federal funds into Northern New Mexico. But he, along with Jenkins, along with Forest Service officials, really thought the solution to this problem of poverty of land loss was simply to forget about it. That's how you solve the problem of land in New Mexico. Is you just, you know, hush up, move on, it's a long time ago, who cares? So, and given that the force of that was everywhere, the force of that opinion, you know, I will credit the Alianza for challenging.
They didn't have the concept of multi-generational PTSD at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been used by the Native American community in terms of talking about their losses.
Well, I mean, I think the multi-generational post-traumatic stress syndrome might have a role to play, but I'm also interested in, because I'm interested in memory, is like, I think it is a remember outside of Mexico. I'm not sure it's remember within Mexico among young people. You know, I don't know. Huh? This is like something that I think only oral history interviews, only talking to a lot of you, any of you know, like, hi, talk to me, or you should talk to so-and-so, just let me know, okay, because that's the next step, I guess. I mean, I've done some interviews, but I haven't.
Have you talked to Dave Greco?
No, he's on it.
I guess that's what you mentioned.
No, he's on my list, I haven't yet. Yeah. Hmm? No, he does talk to me, yeah.
I'm curious, in applying what we're saying about Tiarina and Nuri and the alliance, could you say the same thing about the pursuit of justice in the last
community?
I mean, I think it just sort of lays that out. Here's the three people we talk about. And Mario Campion and the other people who completely love justice.
I think it's different. I really think it's different. I think Tiarina is unique. Yeah, because, and I say this in that article, oh, if you want to, Tiarina is a member entrepreneur, something like that. Reyes López Tiarina, I can't remember for the colon or something at the heart of Chicano history. Yeah, it's really about how he captures or he articulates central themes in Chicano history. But when you're looking at the 1960s and those different progressive movements, Tiarina, if you're looking at that one quote, hold on, go back here. The implication here, and it's forthright in other passages, is that things were better off before conquest, right? That you could go back. I mean, the question is yeah, the answer even a progressive movement? It's so interesting, going back, capturing a forgotten and increasingly disappearing place and time. And so, and it's not like Cesar Chavez could go like, yeah, I've been doing a really great force farm work until the 1930s. I mean, you know, or it's not like Martin Luther King was ever saying, yeah, before segregation, we were slaves. It was terrific. We just need to go back there. It's different. I mean, this idealization of the past, I don't see it working the same way. Although, I mean, I really do like it. I find the planet sound really interesting. And so you have a kind of a creation of a mythical past. But in New Mexico, you don't have to go to myth, man. You don't. You can just go to what happened. So. Where else? Is there a question?
I had a question that might be shifting to another one now. We can get off this topic a little bit. If we're talking about Don Bassan and how that's kind of different from what Lincoln is doing, how do you see that he is reconciling with American Indian claims?
Oh, no, that's a good question. That's one that I didn't mention here. Well, one thing that Indiana does is he goes, we're going to go with funds, right? So he's just saying, and he's, and, you know, people, it depends on who you read. What fraud, man. Because so much in New Mexican history is about Spanish Americans claiming their European lineage, right? And here comes Indiana saying, no, we're going to go with funds, and that's like very convenient because then you claim not just to 1848 and not just to 1598, but like, you know, very straight. So that's one attempt to reconcile it, and it doesn't always work. And it's really interesting that the Arianza's closest relationship are with the Hopi, and the Hopi escaped direct Spanish conquest. Do you know, I mean? So, but he does. He's always reaching out, trying to make alliances, not just with Native Americans, but with African Americans. He's with Palestinians. He's always reaching out with other groups, with white progressives. So it's complicated. I just found it's something that really intrigues me too. That's what I'm talking about, multiple conquests, and I didn't have the time to talk about very much today. But there were members of the Alianza who actually were also members of different pueblos in New Mexico. So finding those people and finding their stories, yeah, that's critical. And again, she was a, you know, really cool woman. This Della Rosa, she's there. She's doing it in 69. So at least I have names and I can start hunting. You know, Tracy, I mean, if you have the last name, Cordova, doesn't really get you very far. You have to sort of know where people come from. But thank God, Mexico is still a relatively small state. Yeah. Jess,
I think that is a more critical approach to rewriting this narrative. Mm-hmm. If you center on Delina's response and use and invoking of Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, he's invoking Article 9, Article 10, Expunged Article 11. Article 12 is the one that's a very interesting article in the treaty. Because mm-hmm. that article promises to protect, right, Mexican citizens from savage Indians. So mm-hmm. it's also an article written in there that, in a very interesting way, aligns the Mexican citizens in this new territory with U.S. citizenry against Native America, right? Mm-hmm. And so instead of looking at the discourses of, you know, Articles 9 and 10 that are about, you know, citizenship and land, there's this other article, right, Article 12, that's very fascinating because it's actually one that pits mm-hmm. savage Indians, right, against the Mexican citizens, right, and makes the U.S. government responsible for protecting these Mexican citizens and their property from these Indians. So, I mean, it seems to me that there's a good way there, but instead of looking at the articles we always look at,
well, or to look at, I mean, to remember that remembering is forgetting, to look at what the Indiana doesn't look at.
Right.
That, too, is very instructive. But it's, what you mentioned actually goes in more than one way. So that one is that you have to think about the Mexican government recognizing Native people as citizens. So
there's like a, they really take a hit. I mean, they really take a hit after 1848 as well. So in that sense, there's a shared history on this, right? And I think I ask this question all the time to individuals because I don't know how to get at the answer except by asking individuals. So you ask someone like Moises Morales, who was a courthouse raider and really interested in Navas Unida, or involved in Navas Unida post La Alianza. He says, you know, we all stole each other's kids. I mean, there's like several hundred years of captives and cousins going on. That, you know, there is this cultural, and I'm going to have to be really careful here because I don't want to idealize it, I don't want to dismiss it, but I don't think that Indo's spine was just like a strategic throwback. I don't think it's just a strategic ploy on his part. I think there's something there. But on the other hand, so you have a shared history, and it's unique in New Mexico, especially because Pueblo Indians are soon recognized as citizens. Like, they're always seen as more advanced than the savage ones, right? So that complicates it. And then, but I think you're right, because I come from Tucson, Arizona, so I have the liberty of talking all about New Mexico, and like, I can't, I'm not taking the land grab. I mean, this is, I'm an outsider, really. I'm just intensely curious, and things that this is important. But if you look at the history of Tucson, Arizona, it's really clear. Tucson, Arizona doesn't come in via war, it comes in via the Gadsden Purchase. And it's really clear that Mexicans, I mean, the Spanish-speaking people in the Pueblo, get along with Anglo-Americans because they better get along because their number one business is to kill Apaches, right? So this is a coming together. So yeah, all those things need to be addressed. I mean, this really is about memory. We're talking about the 1960s, but I got to figure out the 19th century for you to make sense in these important